I think sounds ridiculous, but works pretty well. Should maybe be like the tagline for the entire rhythm game industry.
This is Up, Up, Down, Down, the show about the art and craft of video games. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today is Nigel Brook, 15-year veteran of the games industry, having worked for Radical Entertainment, later Activision, is now co-founder of Steam Clock Software. Hi, Nigel.
Hello.
Also joining us today is Steve Lubitz. Steve is a software developer, longtime Nintendo fan, and the token male co-host of the acclaimed panda-themed gaming podcast, Isometric. Hi, Steve. How's it going?
Good. Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, happy to have you. So our topic today, which may not surprise fans of Isometric that we would have Steve on for this, is rhythm games. The past, the present, and the potential future of rhythm games. And this is something that, you know, I, as most people, I suppose, statistically was kind of introduced to by Guitar Hero, but rhythm games actually have gone back. I mean, there were some pre-PlayStation rhythm games, but it seems like the original PlayStation was, in a lot of ways, the kind of originator system for what we think of a modern video game or modern rhythm game. I saw Parappa the Rapper around that time, and I was just watching another video of it. And I'm like, wow, this is really like it's weird.
It's very
in many
it's
ways.
Very Japanese, is what it is. What it is. It's very, yeah. It's a weird, weird game. I never played much of it either because I never had an original PlayStation, but I was aware of it. And it's like, this is an interesting game. And it's kind of, I don't know how it took off because it's just such an odd concept to try to explain to somebody, especially when there wasn't any sort of like a thing about rhythm games back at the time. But
yeah. And then the other thing, so there's the fact that it's a rhythm game, which is weird. And there's the fact that it's a game about rapping out of Japan, which is weird. And then also the visual style is like the characters are these like pieces of paper with the character kind of pasted on them. Like, I guess sort of like Paper Mario, but they like twist around in like weird ways that are supposedly dancing, but it's like super abstract. I guess, you know, extremely Japanese is the way to put it that maybe explains both its strangeness and its appeal as well. But you had mentioned before the show, Steve, that you had actually played Vib Ribbon, which was another early game. Can you tell us a little bit about that one?
Yeah, this was, again, I didn't play this at the time because I never had a PlayStation. I ended up going down the N64 route, and then I did get a PS2 and kind of picked up on some of this stuff after the fact, but not a whole lot. But they just re-released it for the PlayStation 3 and for the Vita. It was a big thing at E3. I guess not a big thing, but it was part of the E3 announcements this year. Vib Ribbon was a game, and I'm not even sure if it actually ever came to the US or if it was just an import out of Japan, where you have this like bunny-like creature who's walking down a ribbon, hence the name, and it has different like shapes that come out of the ribbon. There's like a block, and there's like a dip in the road, and there's loops that you go around, and you press the shoulder buttons, the down button, and the X button for each one of the different shapes to kind of clear it as he's walking along. And what's interesting about the game is that all the shapes were procedurally generated by the song that was in the background, to the point where it had its own soundtrack, but this was one of the early games. And this is kind of something that hasn't happened again until very recently, where you could put in your own CD and it would generate stages off of the songs on that CD and play with your own music. And it would just generate whatever happened to be based on that algorithm. But that was one of the really, really early games. That was kind of a cult classic that I was aware of when it came out. And it was one of those games that I always wanted to play. And then I got it for my Vita. And it's not really all that exciting right now because, I mean, it's not... Rhythm games aren't really new anymore, but at the time, to be able to play with your own music and have it generate a stage for you was really kind of mind-blowing.
I was watching a video of that at your suggestion, and a couple of things struck me. One was that it seemed like some, not in the way that Parappa the Rapper was weird, this is an entire another like dimension of weird, and that it's almost like I had entered this alternate universe,
yeah,
or some sort of drug trip or something, because the visual style of the game looks almost like it was like a from this like early 80s or even like almost the 70s. It's like this vector graphics. It's 2D, but it's not like 2D is like makes it seem more sophisticated than it is. It's just, you know, a few dozen white lines on a black background. But when I saw that, I'm like, what the heck? This is a PlayStation game? What's going on? And then I realized because you can put in another disc when the game is running, it had to load the entire game into like the what? I don't know, Nigel. How much memory does the PlayStation have? Like
the original PlayStation?
It can't be much.
I want to say like 2 megabytes. I'll make that guess and then I'll look it up on Wikipedia.
Yeah. So you know, whatever it is, like a ludicrously small amount of memory to load this entire game, and on the PlayStation, you don't even really have like much of an operating system. It's just, okay, here's some hardware, make things happen. So I was first disgusted by it, and then I was actually kind of impressed. That's a cool hack.
Yeah, it's definitely a lot more impressive at the time, and now you're playing it and it's kind of like an oddity, and it's like it's not a whole lot of fun to play now. But you know, I mean, especially because these games live and die by their soundtracks, and so any game that you can actually bring your own soundtrack into in this genre is it's way more appealing to a larger group of people than anything with a built-in soundtrack. So that's also kind of a big, I mean, it was just kind of a novelty at the time to be able to. There was another game, I forget what it was, where you could put in like music CDs and it would like generate monsters for you. I forget what the name of it was because I never had a PlayStation. But those kinds of things were like all those little weird things on the PlayStation that were kind of a novelty at the time.
Yeah, whereas now I'm not sure if it would even be possible to release. And maybe they make an exception for a game like that for a novelty. But, games now I start saying that and I realize it's obviously not true anymore. But there was at some point where ejecting a game was required to like stop the entire game, like if you injected the CD. Whereas now you can obviously load it from the hard drive. So you would actually, that would be easy again. Yeah, so that's an interesting hack, but my exposure to rhythm games started, I guess we're talking like late 90s already, like first PlayStation, but was Dance Dance Revolution, which might have been many people's sort of introduction to it in the arcade, which to me is like maybe the last great arcade game. I'm not sure how many arcades are still surviving out where you are, Steve, but it's pretty
not
dead
many
here in
no.
Vancouver. But DDR kind of caused a sort of a renaissance, and in that way, at least the DDR versions I played, they were never some music I recognized. It was never about like, oh, it's so cool to be playing this music I recognize, but being able to really get into the beat of a song and the interpretations of the song as the people who sort of craft the levels of the game was something that was really new to me at that time. And even though I'm like not the sort of person who would normally choose physical activity as my way to express myself in a video game, or at least at that time I wouldn't have been. It was a lot of fun. Did either of you guys get into DDR by any amount?
No, I've played it occasionally at arcades. Like certainly there was a period there where, which I think is still sort of going on, except that arcades are completely dying now. But there was sort of that period there where arcades were still in the process of being killed by home consoles, where stuff like that was really big at arcades because of the need for specialized hardware, right? That it was just all like, 4 banks of Dance Dance Revolution and then like, 16 different light gun games at every arcade. And so I did try it occasionally when I went to arcades in that era, but it certainly never grabbed me the way that, that Guitar Hero did later on.
Yeah. And there was a really performative aspect to it too in arcades. If you got somebody who was really good at it, you would get like a crowd around them, like watching them do their thing, which is kind of, That's kind of built into something like Rock Band as it came in later. But if you ever watch somebody who was like really, really good at DDR, like that was as much of a skill as like any other type of performance art. And it was really a sight to behold.
Oh, yeah. It was amazing.
Yeah. I mean, I got into it. I had to wait until I moved into my current house in 2005 because we had a second floor apartment. And I was afraid that we were going to get evicted if I tried to play DDR. And especially because our neighbors were already complaining about the washing machine at the time. But but I got into it a little bit, but I was never really able to get into it. I tried doing like the DDR for fitness thing that everybody kind of did around that time. That was kind of before the Wii, that was kind of the big get fit using video games fad was to do DDR. And I tried it, but I never really found a soundtrack that really appealed to me. Like I know my co-hosts on Isometric, a couple of them are really into like EDM and into like K-pop and J-pop and stuff like that. And that's never really been my thing. So it never really appealed to me enough to be able to find enough songs on the soundtrack to really be able to get a good playlist going together. And there was always that, you know, the limitation of those games at the time where you were limited to what was on the disc. So if you only liked maybe 5 or 6 songs on the disc, even if you liked, you know, 50 or 60 across, there were a whole bunch of DDRs and DDR maxes and different mixes and stuff like that. But if you only liked 5 or 6 on each soundtrack, you had to keep swapping out the game in order to get, you know, a decent playlist. And that's not really good when you're just trying to, you know, have like a half hour workout or so.
There's also just, I mean, always with those games, there's the problems of managing that hardware. Like, I don't think I've ever seen like the console version of DDR, but I assume it had to come with like some little pad you laid out on the floor or something like that back in those days, right? Like, because that was pre-motion control hardware. Like, all modern games now are sort of keying off the motion of whatever motion control hardware you've got. But like Dance Dance Revolution for PS1 or PS2, like whenever it was, like, did it just come with something that you folded out?
It was
out
like a plastic kind of semi-foamy thing, and I'm sure they had different iterations of it, but it was this plastic pad that you laid out, and it wasn't like the arcade one, like it wasn't that sturdy, because, you know, how sturdy can it be when it's just a peripheral for a game? But you could get aftermarket ones, because it was just like a controller as far as the way it was interacting with the thing. And so when I was in like first or second year of university, one of my friends, his like life ambition was to get, because he was really into DDR, was to get one of the full metal like pads like they had in the arcade, not the entire machine, but just so that you could plug it into the PS2. Or PS1 or PS2, whatever it was at the time. And that was like his, like, he was just completely elated when everyone pitched in together to get this, like, you know, super hardcore metal DDR pad. And man, if they had downstairs neighbors, it would not have lasted long. But thankfully, they were on a ground floor.
And those things are a problem, right? Like, we talked about that a couple episodes ago when we were talking about Guitar Hero and like the peripheral game craze specifically. And, you know, that stuff is hard to justify managing if you're not really into it, you know, like figuring out somewhere to store it and having to haul it out every time you play it. And if, you know, if the controller breaks, like essentially now you're out playing that game until you get the new like $70, $80 controller to play the game with. And that's, you know, that's tough to ask people to do that.
Yeah. I mean, the ones that came out with it were kind of like the power pad for the NES, where it was just kind of like, it was just a plastic pad and it folded up pretty nicely and it kind of would fit under your bed or whatever. But yeah, once you start getting into, you know, heavy expenditures, you know, and then something like that breaks, it can be a problem. And you know, the metal ones don't, maybe they fit under the bed, but they certainly don't fold up. But, you know, obviously if you're willing to spend, and it was not cheap, those metal ones, I mean, they had to be several hundred dollars. And so if you're getting into that kind of expenditure, I think you're pretty much making a life investment in DDR as it is. So,
yeah, but then like you look back on it, I'm my guess would be he's probably not playing it on a regular basis like 5 or 8 years ago or 5 or 8 years later. But yeah, maybe he is. Maybe he's still into it. So DDR probably would then, you know, talking about the peripherals, would probably have taught the sort of supply chain of both the game publishers as well as you know, the studios and developers and everyone, that you can make decent money off this peripherals. Because I don't know, do you remember how much it would have been, Steve, retail to get the game and the dance pad?
I imagine it was probably $60 or $70. I don't think it was that much more expensive. And a lot of the games, the later games, I think just sold by themselves. And then you had to get your own. I remember getting, I got some sort of like DDR Disney mix or something that was like on clearance for like $20 or $30 just to get the gamepad. And then I got like DDR Max or DDR Max 2 as on its own, probably used back then, you know, just to get the actual songs that I wanted. But you could get them, you know, if you didn't care, right? Like if you just want like the power pad version and you just want something because you're going to play DDR once a week, or you think you're going to get into a workout routine, but you're not sure, you could get into it pretty cheap. But they did take up more room on the shelf than a standard box would.
Yeah, for sure. That makes sense. But I mean, not to the degree, I imagine they folded up.
Yeah.
So not to the degree that some of the later peripherals started to get more and more ridiculous. So I was looking through this history a little bit, preparing for the show, and I hadn't really quite realized how fast the sort of Guitar Hero and Rock Band franchises grew and then how fast they crashed. So I wasn't really as focused in like the original Guitar Hero as much as like this the sort of peak of it. But my understanding of the sort of back history of it, and part of what I think caused the oversaturation, is that Guitar Hero started in like 2005 or 2006 from Harmonix, and they had this publishing deal that ended up meaning that Activision ended up owning the sort of Guitar Hero trademark. And so when Activision started to, I guess, make demands that they were not agreeing to, Harmonix was able to go off and make Rock Band and do things their own way. But then suddenly you have two entire studios making, you know, multiple games per year for this sort of format of the sort of guitars. And I guess Rock Band ended up also... What was the story with that? The Rock Band also introduced drums.
I think even keyboards in one of the later versions. Right.
Yeah,
well.
Rock Band 3 introduced the keyboard. The first Rock Band introduced drums and vocals. And vocals wasn't new. They had the Karaoke Revolution games
for a
while before that. And the Karaoke Revolution games, I mean, that's basically what the vocals ended up being in Rock Band. It's almost identical, except that it was just vocals. But those were... really interesting only because it would track the pitch of your voice and would let you sing along with it, but give you enough leeway that you could still be not a perfect singer, but still be able to play the game. Because one of the things with singing, especially, is that if you're playing, you know, in a group, there's a lot of people who are, you know, not very comfortable with their singing voice. Like, I was terrified to sing in front of anybody before I got that game. And then I remember we actually... it was the Super Bowl with the Janet Jackson wardrobe malfunction that we ended up missing because we put on Karaoke Revolution during the and made our own halftime show and got wrapped up in it and then found out about it like 3 hours later after the game was over.
Makes a lot of sense, actually. Like unlike a lot of these other things, karaoke is a long-standing home entertainment thing, you know. Like, I don't know the origin of karaoke machines, but there were like very low-tech karaoke machines before, you know, I don't even want to guess. I guess 80s maybe or earlier, because it can be as simple as just you have you can play music and then you can sing. It can be entirely analog, right?
I mean, it's probably came along with the VHS player. I mean, it's probably what happened. Yeah. Because you need to have a music video playing along to have the lyrics, but that once you right. have that, you're pretty much all set.
Yeah, exactly. And like, people have had fun going out for karaoke for a long time, and I imagine it's getting more popular in recent years, maybe partially through people like you and me being forced to sing in front of people, sing in front of their friends, yeah. and then actually liking it, which actually did end up happening. Like, I wouldn't have sang in front of my friends until Guitar Hero or Rock Band, and then ended up being like, oh, you know, this is pretty fun. Everyone has a couple drinks and we're all on the same page. It's actually pretty good.
I think that's a big part of those rhythm games. You know, we're talking about it before with like DDR in the arcades. And I think a big part of what makes Rock Band and Guitar Hero fun is playing it with other people. Like, playing it on your own, it's, you know, it's interesting, but it's, I don't think it's a game that would be as sticky as it is if it wasn't for the social aspect of it, right? Of like, you get people together at a party and you just like, you know, stick Rock Band on the TV and like, people will come in and play for a little bit. And, you know, you wouldn't most of the time do that with anything else, right? You're not going to like, you know, you're not going to put on like Call of Duty on playing on your PS3 in the living room while you've got a party going on. But doing it with something like Rock Band or Guitar Hero is totally, you know, totally kind of socially acceptable, and people will have fun doing it, even people that aren't necessarily normally gamers. Like, certainly that's something I found a lot in like my group of friends when we sort of went through the Guitar Hero phase is like, yeah, a bunch of us are gamers and they would all play, but also a bunch of people that weren't normally gamers would totally like try it because of that kind of fun social aspect. And I think that's, you know, that's the same thing that's going on with karaoke, right? That's like, there's something fun about a bunch of people that aren't necessarily the most, like, the best singers, the most rhythmically inclined, like, getting together and kind of goofing around and having fun with music. And, you know, both karaoke and Guitar Hero kind of fill that need.
How much do you guys think that that, and I totally agree that that party atmosphere is a huge part of, I think, the success of all those games and all those activities. But how much do you think is about the fact that it's music, or do you think it's like one level more abstract in that it's a non-gamey novel way to a novel form of entertainment? Like, compare it to like Wii Tennis. Like, that was another thing where people will come over for parties and like my mom, who doesn't play games at all, I was like, oh, you got to try this Wii Tennis thing. But I wouldn't have been like, you got to try Destiny. Like, the graphics are really good. I would obviously not, it wouldn't even occur to me, right? And nor would she like it if I had. But the sort of like, hey, here's a novel way to interact with the game system, a novel way to, I don't know. It feels like that might be some aspect of it as well.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is. I mean, because Guitar Hero and Guitar Hero 2 were just the guitar. And those games were smash hits, too, before Rock Band and Guitar Hero 3 introduced the full band setup. I mean, even Guitar Hero 2, you could play with, like, one person on guitar and one person on bass. But that was kind of unusual because each one only came with one guitar controller anyway. So to have two guitar controllers in the same place wasn't as common as it was, like, with Rock Band, where you got the whole band in the kit for $200.
Band
so,
box.
Yeah. So I fired up Rock Band this morning. Just, I haven't played it in a while. It's probably been like a year. But I fired it up just to get back into it and kind of feel that again. And I do play guitar on expert. I'm not every song, but like generally I can make my way through anything like a 3 or 4 difficulty on expert, and the easier songs I can 5-star usually. Which has taken a lot of practice and a lot of just kind of on my own playing, because you can't get that good playing with, you know, people all the time. There just aren't people around all the time.
They'll get bored eventually of you. Yeah. No, let's do it again.
Yeah. And I mean, even Guitar Hero 2, I remember when I was making the transition from like medium to hard on the Guitar Hero controller. I mean, I'm sure everyone's played Guitar Hero, but just, you know, in case you haven't, the Guitar Hero controller has 5 fret buttons of different colors, and easy and medium use 3 and 4 frets respectively, so that your hand never moves. And hard introduces the orange fret, where you actually have to shift your hand position in order to hit all the frets that are on the guitar. So it's Guitar Hero 2's difficulty curve was terrible. And there was this this song called Woman by Wolfmother. I still remember it, and I still cannot listen to that song to this day because it was in the first tier of the Guitar Hero songs that you needed to beat in order to progress. And it had a number of what are called hammer-ons and pull-offs, where you have a number of notes that are in fast succession, and you hit them by moving your hand, by pressing the frets without strumming, which is it's more of an advanced technique. I mean, you're just trying to learn how to hit the orange fret at that point, and they're making you do this in like over and over and over again. I must have played that song about 150, 200 times before I finally cleared it, and then I never wanted to listen to that song ever again.
They were doing it, the pull offs on every single bar, right? Like the da na 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 na. And so you have to literally do it like 400 times correctly, or
in a row.
Yeah,
in a row without failing. Yeah, and it just, I remember just sitting there in front of the television, like playing that song over and over again for hours, just trying to clear it so I could get better. And I got better because of it. But you know, I mean, that's the kind of thing that I wouldn't have done if I wasn't like really invested in the game at that point. But
It's not even so much that those are like casual games. They hit that really nice sweet spot of really easy to pick up, but lots of depth there if you're willing to go to the harder difficulty levels. That transition from medium to hard, like that's a difficult jump to make. And there's lots of people that just can't make that jump, right? Like just aren't capable of going from medium to hard, and don't have the energy to sort of put the time into making it, which I part of it you can say is sort of like a design failing, but it's a design failing almost caused by, you know, by the initial constraints that you've set up, right? Of like, once you say, okay, we've got these buttons that you need to press, and if there's as many of them as your fingers, it's relatively straightforward. And if there's more, it's much, much harder. And there's no real transition point there.
And at the end of the day, you're not simulating a guitar if you're not moving your hand on the fret. I mean, that's what a real guitarist is doing, is they're moving their hand up and down the fretboard in order to hit different chords. So if you're not having people doing that, at some point, you know, you can make it easier. And easy mode is really easy for anybody to pick up after a couple of tries. But if you're not, you know, if you're not adding that fifth fret to force your hand to move up and down the fretboard, you're not really giving, I mean, not that, I mean, I couldn't play real guitar if I wanted to. I tried the pro guitar in Rock Band 3 and it was not happening. But, you know, it's enough of an abstraction that I can kind of feel like I am. And part, what really has to grab you is that you have to feel like you're playing guitar. Like, the feeling that you get when you're doing this, especially when you're playing solo, is like, when you're hitting the notes, you're hitting the notes. It's not that you're just, like, hitting buttons in time with the notes. You feel like you're hitting the notes. And if you're not really simulating a guitar as much as you possibly can, you don't necessarily feel like you're hitting the notes. I mean, really, when you get into, especially on Expert, when you get into a groove of, like, a song that you know, and you know you're pressing the buttons and you're strumming the guitar, you're strumming the strum button, and it's hitting the notes and it's playing the notes at the time that you're strumming, that is a feeling that is really hard to reproduce just with, like, a controller. I mean, not that you can't play a game like Amplitude or Rock Band Blitz, where you are just pressing the buttons on the controller in time with the music, and you can kind of feel something there. But it's not the same as I'm holding down the frets, I'm strumming, and the notes are coming out. And it's almost, especially on Expert, where you're really replicating it note for note, it makes you feel like you are playing guitar even though you're not. And that's an amazing kind of illusion that they're able to pull off with that game.
It's really a genius balance in between simulating the guitar enough to give you that feeling that you're in the zone, that you, it sort of breaks the connection in between your brain and the fact that it's a plastic controller, and then you just goes right from your brain to the music as if you're creating the music, which is obviously an illusion, but no more complexity than that. Like, they were able to figure out, or maybe it's just some constraint that they weren't able to do more buttons for one reason or another, but they were figured out that all that they needed to do is that one more button than the number of fingers that you have, and then you have the movement, and then suddenly it breaks from, and like, I have felt that experience going from medium to hard, and then, you know, more of it going to Expert, but that once you're moving up and down the fretboard, even though you're only moving down one, which is like, and then also there's no, like, you know, the whole, each fret isn't just one button, right? You, like, you could imagine them going, well, we need to at least have, like, the bass strings and the treble strings on this. It's like, no, you don't need anything other than five frets, and then you've got it. And they were able to create that sense of flow that I actually ended up because of Rock Band and Guitar Hero, being inspired to actually pick up a guitar and start learning it. So I've been playing for maybe about 5 years or 6 years, however long since it became a sensation. And only in the last year or so have I gotten good enough in guitar that I've actually gotten the sense of flow playing real guitar, like with friends playing music and getting that sense of like, man, I'm hearing this music and it's almost like, wow, this music is just like happening and everything's just flowing. Like, it took me 5 years to get to the sense of like flow that I was making music that I got from actually playing a plastic instrument, which is pretty remarkable that they were able to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I thought about doing that too, and I wanted to, and except the problem is that this game came out right around when my first child was born. So it kind of, by the time that I was actually, you know, when this was going on with Wolf Mother's Mother, Wolf Mother's Woman, rather, I mean, that was while my daughter was taking naps, right after she was first born. So it's like I got good at it, but then I was at the point where I didn't really have the free time to be able to pick up an instrument at that point. But I mean, I definitely wanted to. And I think that Harmonix figured that a lot of people wanted to, which is why they tried to introduce the pro instruments in Rock Band 3 that would teach you how to play real guitar in theory. But that didn't seem like it was either. It didn't seem like it was something that a lot of people were interested in, or it was just kind of too little too late in that life cycle of the product.
I think there's also just a factor of the the difficulty curve for playing real guitar is a lot more unforgiving, you know, like as hard as that transition from medium to hard in Guitar Hero is, like real guitars are much, much more complicated.
Yeah. And I think the part of the problem was, is there's probably a lot of people like me who, I bet if you were to graph like beginner guitar sales in North America during those years, you'd see this spike as well, as people were like, oh man, I want to pick this up and I want to try and learn this instrument. There's probably more people who bought, my guess would be, there's more people who bought a real guitar because I've got Guitar Hero than people who bought the learn to play like Rocksmith and the pro guitars and stuff like that. Because when once you're getting to that, once you're really getting outside of that, this is a game and you're taking this seriously, then it's kind of like, might as well just go all the way. Really, that's the way I felt about it. So we sort of talked around it a little bit, but the growth and the crash of this of this market is really remarkable. I'm sure there's other examples in game history, like maybe the giant E.T. landfill of 1983 or whatever it was. But the Rock Band, or the Guitar Hero only came out in 2006. I'm going to actually verify this. It was 2005. So Guitar Hero starts in 2005. By 2008, the market peaks to the point where, the rhythm games and the hardware that goes with it was 18% of the video game market. So in 3 years, genre goes from zero to 20%, like a fifth of the entire market. The next year, it crashed in half. The year after, it crashed in half again. So the sort of flow of it ended up being such that Guitar Hero 3 in 2008 sold 1.4 million copies in its first week, and Guitar Hero Warriors of Rock, which was 2 years later, only sold 89,000 copies in the first week, so like 3% of as many. Which is pretty dramatic turnover. And I think that, like, we discussed this a little bit on episode 2 or 3 of Up, Up, Down, Down, which statistically looking at the amount of growth we had in our audience since then, almost zero of you have probably listened to. but we had some sort of debate, and I'd be interested to hear your perspective on it, Steve, as to how much of that collapse was because they just made too many freaking sequels, and oh my god, there was 24 Guitar Hero games in 2009, and that's not me joking, that's actually how many Guitar Hero SKUs there was in 2009, is 25. How much of it was that, and how much of it was just that the sort of the Wii motion control thing, like people wanted to try it out, and then they tried it out, and they're like, okay, cool.
Yeah, I mean, one thing is Guitar Hero and Rock Band, I mean, Guitar Hero was definitely the inferior series. Once you got past Guitar Hero 2 and Activision took it over themselves. And the big differentiator between the two, other than the fact that, you know, there's always the Coke and Pepsi type of thing where Harmonix was making the real deal and Activision was just kind of doing what they could with the code that Harmonix had left over. But the big difference between the two games was really the downloadable content. I mean, Rock Band made an effort to release like 5 or 6 tracks every single week for years. And it was like an event if Guitar Hero released like a couple of tracks. I mean, there were some like whole albums that Rock Band would drop in a week. And it's just like, here's the entire, I forget which albums they ended up doing, but there were definitely several full albums that they would just drop down. But the problem was that there's definitely a saturation because what would happen is that they were just kind of pushing each other to release more features. And the only way you could really release more features and justify it was to release a new game. So you'd have Guitar Hero 3 that would also have the band, and then it would have something that Rock Band would have to implement in Rock Band 2. And they kind of go back and forth. And there's just so many of those games that you can justify buying for $60 at launch when really there were maybe a couple of new features. I mean, the Rock Band 3 was definitely, if you look at Rock Band 3 and you look at the original Rock Band, there was definitely like an evolution from 1 to 3, where 3 had, made it much easier to get into playlists. It had, it made it a lot easier to kind of just set up some songs that your friends wanted to play and play it. And it also had a pretty robust storyline. But at the end of the day, the game wasn't really any different other than the extra instruments that it introduced that at that point, I don't think anybody was really interested in buying. So yeah, it definitely is. There's only so many, you know, times that you can introduce a set and put more plastic instruments on the shelves. And those boxes took up a lot of room. I mean, I imagine most stores had most of the stock in the back room, but those boxes took up like a whole like quarter of a shelf. And that's, if those aren't selling, that's going to be kind of the kiss of death for that really, really quickly. And at the end of the day, you just kind of get into a point where even as somebody who's owning it, it's like, well, do I really have to keep this cluttering up my living room for that long too? If I'm, you know, if I'm playing it like once a week or once every 2 weeks, it's a lot of, especially the drum set. I mean, the drum set was really like a whole thing that you had to have room for in your house. I mean, the guitars you could kind of tuck in a corner a little bit, but the drum set was like a full mini drum set that you had to put somewhere. And if you don't have the kind of apartment or the kind of house that has storage for that, that's kind of a difficult decision. And that's going to be the first thing that's going to go if you're making a decision about, you know, having some extra room in your house that you need to clear up.
Yeah, the inventory apparently was, I hadn't realized to the degree of it until some of the stuff has started coming out for, like from Harmonix. They've sort of woken up again and they get giving interviews and stuff. But one of the producers at Harmonix said that one of the major factors in sort of the genre getting closed down for a few years was the unsold inventory lost everyone a lot of money. Like they made a lot of money in 2008, but in 2009 and 2010, the stores were losing money, the publishers were losing money, everyone was losing money on the sort of shipping the, like huge quantities of plastic instruments around and then holding on to them and then sending them back when they didn't sell. And it was just, they're taking a bath because, you know, imagine compared to, oh, okay, well, if we really, everybody thinks that, you know, this, that Gex 3 is going to be really popular, it's going to be a great game. And then they order thousands and thousands and thousands of copies of Gex 3. And then, oh, actually, no, it's ended up, no one's buying this. Then sending them back, the shipping cost on the plastic discs was pretty low. And that's not the case on plastic instruments, unfortunately. So,
and it's not like you can sell them without the without including them either, because I mean, it's not like you could do anything with a controller other than choose the song.
Right.
Like you have to have those with them, and you can't, you know, send somebody home with a $60 game and then they get home and then find out, oh, well, I need to go spend another $30, $40 in order to play this. Like that's not going to be okay. So you had to include those. And that eventually became the kiss of death when they just kept having to ship a whole new set of instruments, even though the instruments never changed. I mean, I think they had like minor revisions, but the instruments didn't really change, but you had to keep shipping them every time you came out with a new game, and people just didn't necessarily want them anymore if they already had them.
And if you did want them, it was also fairly difficult to get a hold of them once things were on the downswing. Like I went through that with, I had both one of my guitars die and then couldn't, like, basically I went into the stores and either I had to buy a game that I already owned to get like the standard guitar, or I had to buy one of the ridiculously expensive add-on guitars, right? Like there's no way to just buy the basic guitar without a game. And then I had my drum set die. A mouse or rat or something got into our like unfinished portion of our basement where it was stored and chewed on a bunch of the cords. And like I, you know, it was one of those things of there was just no conceivable way to get a replacement drum set. Like you couldn't buy them in stores without spending way more money because you had to buy the whole thing. It was hard to track them down on like eBay or Craigslist or anything like that. And something like that, like I'd rather do it on Craigslist than on eBay because I want to see the thing before I get it. And, you know, it was like the guitar, I eventually did manage to find one on Craigslist to, you know, at a reasonable price to replace my guitar that died, but the drum set just never, you know, I'd sort of tried to solder it back together myself and couldn't get it working. I was just like, all right, this is broken now. Like there's nothing I can do about it.
Yeah. I've been really lucky because I have the guitars that I have two guitars that I got when I bought Rock Band or guitar, not Guitar Hero. Did I buy Guitar Hero 2? I don't even remember what I bought. Something for my Xbox 360 when I got it, because I had been playing the old games on the PS2 I actually played the original Rock Band on the PS2, which is a terrible experience. It's about as bad as on the Wii because it was basically, it would run, but just barely, and there was no downloadable content or anything like that. But I got two of the Explorer guitars that came with Guitar Hero 2, and I've had those since like 2008, and they just keep, I've been beating the living hell out of them, and they just keep working. So, I mean, every time I play with a Rock Band guitar, it's kind of like a foreign experience for me because I'm just used to that Guitar Hero 2 controller because that's what I've always used, and it's just lasted forever. But I guess they weren't making it. I'm sure that once they got into manufacturing them in the kinds of quantities that they had to in the height of it, they probably ended up cutting some corners, and they might not have been, they might not have been quite as meticulous with the build quality as they were in the early days, too.
Well, if you look back on it, the number of instruments that people wanted to buy in 2008, and the fact that they couldn't keep them in stock, and the fact that it was a fad that, or you know, it was, at the time, you know, you could say that it was a fad that the opportunity window was really small. So it's, they will sell every guitar they can make in the next 6 months, and they could just print money, and then after that, it's too late. So you know, rushing them out the door might have been a strong corporate incentive at Activision. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised.
I think in some ways, like when we talk about the decline and fall of Rock Band and Guitar Hero, I think it is as much the story of the plastic instruments going out of fashion as rhythm games themselves. Because, of course, the other thing that's going on is the rhythm game market hasn't, certainly it's down from its peak, but it hasn't gone away as much as it has if you just look at like Rock Band and Guitar Hero, because Just Dance came along in that period as well, right? Like that was 2008 or 2009 was the first Just Dance release. And when you, particularly on a platform like the Wii, where I think it's been extremely successful, I don't know how if it's done as well on like PS3, Xbox 360, but like the Wii, everyone's got the Wiimotes and it just kind of works. Like you don't need to screw around with any plastic instruments, but you get the same kind of thing out of it that you're, at least for casual players. Certainly, I wouldn't say that Just Dance has that same, you know, the same reward factor for people that are willing to sink time into it that Rock Band and Guitar Hero do, but certainly for casual players, it's got exactly all the same things going for it that Rock Band and Guitar Hero do, except that you don't have to buy a bunch of plastic crap to play it. You can just play it with your regular Wii remotes, you know?
Just Dance was more popular than I'd realized. It was actually the most popular third-party Wii game of anything. It wasn't one of the big franchises. It wasn't any, I guess it is cross-platform, but I believe Just Dance started on the Wii, and it ended up just selling ridiculous amounts. Apparently it was fairly poorly reviewed, but it sold extremely well. I've only played it once or twice with Katie, Nigel's daughter. I was like, she wanted to play Just Dance. I'm like, okay, I don't really understand how this works or what's exactly going on, but yeah it was fun enough.
Yeah, I got one of the kids ones for my kids for the Wii U, and they played it for like half an hour, and then they're like, yeah, okay, this is fine, let's still do something else now. And you know, I mean, they're not really old enough to, you know, like a lot of the music that's in there, but it just seemed like it wasn't really anything that was interesting to them. I mean, I know there's a lot of people who get really into Dance Central, which was the Kinect game that Harmonix put out. That's a game that I think I tried the demo and I just couldn't make it work because I'm not coordinated at all in that way.
How is it supposed to work? Do you know, like in my mind, I don't perceive the Kinect as being good enough to tell if you're actually dancing quite right. I don't know. Is it just kind of gross? Like put your arms up, put your arms down, put your left arm out, like kind of that level of detail?
Yeah, I think it's tracking the motions that you're doing. It's been a long time since I've tried it, but it works well enough because, I mean, at PAX every year, there's a stage that's entirely for Dance Central, and there's a lot of people who get extremely into it and they're really good at it and that are performing at a high level, as high a level as you would expect with Rock Band, which they also have a free play stage set up every year. So, I mean, it works. It's never really been my thing. I know Brian Wu, who's one of my co-hosts on Isometric, she has always been a really big fan of Dance Central, all of them. And she likes it a lot. But I've never really been able to get into it. But that's not really, that's mostly because of my inability to move in a coordinated way. And also because I'm not really a fan of the pop music that a lot of the soundtrack really goes to. Again, that's kind of you know, all these games live and die by their soundtracks. And if you don't like the music that's in it, then it's not going to appeal to you. And that's always been kind of my bugbear with Dance Central and Just Dance, is because I never really liked pop music. So for me, it's kind of hard for me to get into those games when you don't like the music to begin with.
Yeah, and that's definitely there's sort of a character difference in the music between something like Guitar Hero, Rock Band, and Just Dance, right? Like, you're not going to get a lot of Aerosmith songs in Just Dance, and you're probably not going to get nearly as much like Katy Perry in Rock Band, you know? Like,
right,
there's exactly. Definitely, they're catering to people with different musical tastes. But I think it's, you know, it's one of those things where both groups are large enough that from a success of the industry standpoint, like trading in one for the other was kind of an okay trade of like, yeah, there's like, I'm kind of the same way. I'll play Just Dance with Katy, but I don't enjoy it. Whereas like both Guitar Hero and Rock Band, I put some of the time into it. Not sounds like to the degree that you did, but you know, there was times I would just sit down and play those games by myself because they're more challenging games and they're games that I really like the music because I'm like a rock and roll and heavy metal kind of guy. Whereas for Just Dance, like part of it with Katy is that she does really like that music. Like she really is interested in kind of modern pop music and like the stuff that's on, you know, that's on the radio, on like the top 40 stations when we're in the car and stuff like that. Like she likes all that music. So the fact that she recognizes the songs is an incentive for her to want to play the game.
Yeah. Well, that doesn't seem though, like fundamentally you couldn't have a dance, you know, as somebody who is willing to dance, but only to pop rock or like, you know, appropriately not EDM type music. If you look at something like the soundtrack to DJ Hero and they've got like, you know, Queen and Daft Punk and stuff like that, like stuff that is danceable, like when you put it together in certain mixes and stuff like that, I feel like there could be a dance game that, you know, those of us who are more into rock would be able to enjoy.
You just have to have like the wedding dance game where it's just all like the Macarena and YMCA.
God, no.
Yeah, I mean, and you could have kind of, but if every one of those games is going to have a theme. I mean, if you don't like, you know, like club music, you're not really going to get into DJ Hero. I mean, even if Queen is in there, like that's not Queen like you would be playing in Rock Band. Like that's probably still not going to appeal to you if you're not into that type of music to begin with.
Yeah, maybe that's true. Maybe I'm just being hopeful. So we have to at least touch on, for those who have not been following the storyline with the industry in the last few weeks, is that Rock Band is coming back. And so there's actually a link up, an in-depth sort of interview that the Harmonix folks did with Polygon talking about, you know, what their sort of thinking is behind bringing it back. And it seems like a back to basics, sort of the thing that you would expect when they're like, okay, this got a little out of hand last time. We're going to just rein it back in. No pro guitars, no keyboards. You know, they're going to cut the accordion, you know, and just stick with the original vocals, guitar, bass, and drums. And the really cool thing that I totally would not have expected is that they're trying to get the rights for all the DLC, so that if you've bought previous songs, you'll be able to play them on the new game, which is very cool.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the big thing that you have to do, because it's... And to make it cross-platform, too, obviously, because these are going to be PS4 and Xbox One games, and all the DLC is living on people's Xbox 360s and PS3s. So not only to get the rights to it, but also to get it to be able to download on the new platforms, which is going to be kind of a big deal. I mean, especially for me, like, I've got... when I looked at my Rock Band library, I've got, like, 400 songs in there. So that's not an insignificant expenditure. And you know, if you're someone like me who's going to be the target market for this, because they're not looking for everybody anymore, they're looking for people like me who love Rock Band and want to play more of it, then they really need to be able to do that. But I think what, yeah, I'm really excited about as far as this Rock Band is concerned is that, I mean, once you got to Rock Band 3, they were kind of throwing every feature under the sun. It almost got into like a spec war between Rock Band and Guitar Hero, and they had to keep throwing more and more and more stuff into the game to justify why you would want to spend another $60 on it. And they don't need to do that this time, because the justification for why do you want to buy Rock Band 4 is, well, I have a PlayStation 4 or an Xbox One. I want to be able to play Rock Band, and this is the only way I'm going to be able to do it. So the justification is built in. So now all they need to do is make a really good game, and without having to look over their shoulder at Activision, they can really make the game that they want to make and not the game that the market is telling them that they have to make. And that makes me really excited for this, because I know that when Harmonix really wants to make a game and they make the games that they want to make, they can make them really, really fantastic. So that's why I'm really excited about it.
I think the new platforms is definitely a big part of it. Like, I've got the Guitar Hero World Tour is the one. Like, I had some of the Rock Band ones secondhand for, like, I think for PlayStation 2 at one point, and then I got rid of my PlayStation, I ended up getting Guitar Hero World Tour, and I think that was the last instrument ones that I got. Like, then I got, like, one of the other Guitar Hero games, and got, like, Beatles Rock Band, and never really got into the DLC stuff, but I definitely would not have considered, after having the first round of Plastic Instruments, like, ever getting another one with the Plastic Instruments, you know? Like, but now it's like, okay, well, if I wanted to play those, now not only are all the guitars, like, sitting in my basement, but the Xbox 360 is now sitting in the basement as well, because, you know, the PS4 is plugged into the TV where the Xbox 360 used to be. And so if I wanted to play the games now, it's even more work to get it all set up. Whereas if it's just like, oh, hey, Rock Band 4 comes out and that looks cool and it supports the PS4, like, okay, yeah, maybe I would think about picking that up in a way that I wouldn't have gotten a new game with the instruments in the sort of downturn of the industry, even though I got some of the standalone games there.
Yeah, I mean, when I set it up to play this morning, I'm looking at it like, oh, I really don't, like, I still have my Xbox 360 hooked up, but it's like, I really don't want to do this. okay, and I load it up, and then it's yelling at me that it needs an update, and it's yelling at me that the game needs an update because I haven't launched it in like 6 months or so. And it's like, it's just, I don't want to deal with the Xbox. I want to be able to put the Xbox into the basement and just use the new platforms, but I'm keeping it hooked up almost exclusively because of Rock Band, because, you know, I want to play it. My kids like Lego Rock Band and ask me to play it every so often, and that's where I have to play it, and there's no other way to do it. So, I mean, just even though it would probably mean I'd have to buy an Xbox One that I don't own already, because it doesn't sound like if the cross-platform compatibility is probably not going to go between Sony and Microsoft. But even so, it's still cheaper for me to spend $350 on a new Xbox and spend $800 on buying all that DLC again. So, and it's kind of an excuse to buy another platform, which I'm always looking for.
Something you'd mentioned, yeah. Something you'd mentioned was, oh, well, it'll be nice for the Harmonix folks to not have to worry about Activision kind of breathing down their neck. But as maybe won't surprise us, but is maybe slightly depressing, Activision has kind of confirmed, not confirmed, that they are also going to make a Guitar Hero game because they just can't help themselves. And the Harmonix people have specifically said that they're going to avoid any sort of arms race. They're going to avoid trying to release too many titles. And something that was interesting that, you know, there hasn't been a lot that they've said really that they are going to do. They've more said what they're not going to do. They're like, well, we're not going to do keyboards. We're not going to do pro guitars and stuff like that. But one thing that they sort of have hinted at is that they're going to go more for, and this sort of answers some of the question of how do you avoid getting the situation that they did in 2008, is that they want to try and make it so that they release a game and that they actually then do updates to that game rather than trying to have like multiple retail releases in a short time. And that makes sense if their model now is more around DLC. If they're like, okay, if we just re-release, I mean, I guess they're maybe calling it Rock Band 4, but if they call it, say, okay, Rock Band 4 is our, you know, for the next couple of years, this is our jam. And then they release updates for Rock Band 4 that maybe add new features or, you know, make it better or improve it based on fan feedback, but they're continually releasing DLC, then it works kind of the more of like the App Store model where, you know, people have been getting free updates to games that they've bought based on the feedback, and then that drives more sales of the game. So be interested to see if that works.
Yeah, the other thing that's different about Harmonix in 2015 as opposed to Harmonix in like 2008 is that in 2008, the Rock Band and Harmonix, they were synonymous. Like, that was their only product at the time. And Harmonix since then is really diversified. I mean, like we talked about Dance Central. They did the Fantasia game for Kinect. They just released a bullet hell shooter, A City Sleeps, a couple months ago. They're bringing the new Amplitude back as well that they had a Kickstarter for a few months ago. That's coming out for PS4 as well. So they're building a lot of different games and kind of diversifying and not putting all their eggs in one basket. Whereas when they were doing Rock Band and they were heavy into Rock Band, that was their only focus. And that might have been the only thing that MTV and EA kind of let them do as being part of a public company. But now that they're back independent, they can kind of do different things. And I mean, there's no way that they would have been releasing a bullet hell shooter in 2008. Like that wasn't happening.
Is this Retrograde? Is that the...
No, this is a game called A City Sleeps that came out a couple months ago. That it's not, I mean, Retrograde is strictly a rhythm game. A City Sleeps is a bullet hell shooter that integrates the music into the game. So what's interesting is that you're shooting in the rhythm of the song. So your bullets kind of change frequency as the tempo of the song goes up and down.
Right.
So you kind of have to plan, you know, how your character is going to be firing based on how the song is, the ebbs and flows of the song, which is kind of an interesting
sort of like to wrap it all the way back to the beginning of the genre, Rez, which was like the first rhythm. It's not a rhythm game quite the same way as these are, but it's definitely got like rhythm elements to it. I think it was the first game that I ever played where I was like, hey, there's something interesting. Like there's something interesting about this, you know, tie in with like music and rhythm as gameplay.
Yeah, I mean, Rez was an on-rail shooter that would each level was like a track that would kind of intensify in tempo and in intensity as you went through the different sub stages. And then when you were locking onto enemies and destroying enemies, those would kind of create beats that would kind of have you almost participating in the song. And then also you had the rumble from the controller that was intensifying along with the beats. You were kind of feeling the beat as you were going along. And that's more of the kind of a subgenre, it's not even so much a rhythm game, but it's kind of a game that really integrates music really tightly into the game, which is a different kind of, there's a lot of games that are coming out like that now. Beat Buddy is one that is a platformer that kind of works that way. Child of Eden is another one from the same creator of Rez that was along the same lines. And even Luminous for the PSP was kind of had a track. And then that was more of a puzzle game. But when you would clear blocks away, it would kind of create beats in that same song as well. So it kind of made you feel like you were affecting the song that was the background of the stage.
And I think they all tap into this sort of thing in people's brains that make, you know, that make this genre appealing in the same way that like first person shooters tap into the kind of, you know, violence, flight or fight kind of instinct that there's, you know, clearly people have some kind of rhythm, you know, deep seated rhythm instinct, like all the way back to like, you know, people in caves, you know, singing songs together, stuff
banging
like that.
Banging on rocks with sticks.
Yeah, banging on rocks with sticks. Like there's some, you know, there's some sort of primal part of our brain that enjoys that sort of thing. And, you know, both Rock Band and something like Rez, like tap into that in kind of different ways of one is saying, okay, here's the rhythm, you've got to follow it. And the other's saying, all right, do what you need to do and we'll make a, you know, we'll make some music out of that.
Yeah.
Crypt of the Necrodancer actually really ties into that fight or flight thing in that, you know, the game is set up is that it's playing the music and the beat is going and the beat is very consistent, but you have to make an action on each beat and you have a very wide array of actions that you can make because it's a roguelike. So maybe you use an item, maybe you fight, maybe you attack, maybe you step backwards, and maybe you take cover or whatever, but it gets this intensity where you're constantly, you're making decisions and you don't have enough time to make the right decisions sometimes, that makes it really fun. I got that game when it was first early access and I've been listening to the soundtrack even when I'm not playing it. It's one of my jam tunes, and so I need to pick it up again. I think they're getting pretty close to like a 1.0. They were saying on Twitter that they're starting to do the final triage for the game, so I would encourage people to check that out when it's check it out now, but if you haven't or you're on the fence, then it should be should be quote unquote done, which games are never really done nowadays, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, we that was actually our indie game of the year on Isometric this past year, despite the fact that it was early access, because it's that good and because it was, we kind of felt like it was, even if you bought it in the state that it was in, it was a complete enough game and you'd enjoy yourself immensely. But it's, they really, and there was, I'll see if I can dig it up. There was an article on Gamasutra a couple months ago about how they had to design the rhythm mechanic for that, because they couldn't make it really strict, because if you, they didn't want it to be frustrating, and there's like a lot of leniency in how close you have to be to the beat in order to be successful in making an action. So they kind of had to play with that a lot in order to be, still feel like you were playing along with the music, but also have it not be a frustrating experience. But it's really interesting the way that that kind of mechanic works out, because you really, what you end up doing is paying attention to the patterns of the enemies, and you almost feel like you're dancing around them to try to hit where they need to go, to just kind of like find a, to find a gap in their attack motion so that you can kind of sneak in and attack them. And it feels like you're dancing around them. And just to kind of take it all the way back, the really interesting thing about that game is that you can actually plug a Dance Dance Revolution controller into it, and then you can control, all the controls are with the four arrow keys, so that translates to the four arrows on the DDR controller. So if you actually want to play it as a DDR game, you can, and they tone down the difficulty for that, so you know, knowing that it's going to be a little bit harder to do that with your feet as opposed to with the arrow keys. But that's kind of a really interesting way to integrate that old hardware and give you kind of a new experience, a completely different experience. But it's really kind of an awesome thing that I wouldn't even have thought of, but that they were able to integrate. And that's also a game that you can bring your own music into as well if you want to.
Yeah, I like how Ryan Clark, the developer, who's actually, it's a Vancouver thing, so probably has a place in my heart because of that. Ryan Clark has said that even though he was inspired by some of the other like random generated games like Spelunky and stuff like that, he wanted to make sure that when you die, you know it was your fault. And that's something that, it's kind of just falls out of the fact that it's this rhythm and this beat, and then it's forcing you to make decisions at this high pace, that you will die not because you tried to do something and did the wrong thing. You will die because you did the wrong thing under time pressure, which feels more like, I'm an idiot. I walked right into that guy, into the dragon or whatever. And it makes me want to keep playing it more than if it's just like, oh, well, yeah, the dragon went one way versus another way. And like, how could I have anticipated that, you know?
I've played a lot of Spelunky and haven't been able to get into it, but because of that, because I feel like it's just punishing me a lot and I just get frustrated with it. But I never felt that way with Crypt of the Necrodancer. It's always like, oh, well, that, you know, that just happens, and let me just try again really quick.
Yeah, sign of a good game. Cool. Any last call outs in the
We should probably talk about this weird retrograde game since you brought it up, and since I brought it up in the show notes. But it's this game, I don't even know if it's a PS3 exclusive. I think it's on Steam now, where it starts at the end of the game where you've defeated the final boss, and then there's like this time space rift that opens up, and the way that you have to close the rift is by undoing all of your actions that you've done in time that you've done them. So what ends up happening is that it looks like a side-scrolling, like a Gradius-type game, but you're actually hitting all the buttons in time with the shots that are coming out, which ends up being the notes that are in the music in the background track. And it's actually also kind of like Crypt of the Necrodancer, where you can hook it up to a DDR controller. There's five lanes in this game where you're shooting, so you can actually hook a Guitar Hero controller up to it and play it that way. And it's a really interesting game that, you know, it's one of these things that you'd be able to pick up on a Steam sale or on like a PS3, a PSN sale. And I would recommend it just because it's such a weird concept, but it sounds ridiculous, but it works pretty well. And it's got a good soundtrack behind the scenes too. So it's the kind of thing that I don't think a lot of people have heard of, but it's kind of a fun little game that's a really weird twist on kind of the same kind of gameplay.
I think sounds ridiculous, but works pretty well. Should maybe be like the tagline for the entire rhythm game industry.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole thing, like if you described it to someone who'd like never experienced that was popular, they'd be like, what are you? No, people are going to buy plastic instruments and pretend to play them. And that's, yeah, that's going to be your game. The whole genre is just like, it shouldn't work. And yet it does work exceptionally well.
Sounds ridiculous, but it really works. All right, Steve, where can people find more about you and what you're up to?
Well, you can follow, I'm on Twitter at WickedGood. I have my own blog where I do a little bit of my writing at multiball.net, but really where you would find me is Isometric, which is currently on 5x5, but we just announced that we're moving to Relay FM in the middle of next month.
Very exciting.
Yeah, we're really excited about it. I mean, you know, 5x5 has been great. We just talked about it on the show on Thursday. That's coming out tomorrow when we record this. You know, 5x5 is a great network, but we're really excited about the kind of stuff that Relay is doing, especially since Brianna Wu, who's my co-host, one of my co-hosts, started Rocket over there. So we're really excited about that. But that's a weekly show that we talk about gaming from different perspectives, which I do with Brianna Wu of Giant Space Cat, who makes Revolution 60 on iOS, and Maddie Myers, who's the assistant games editor for Pace Magazine, and Georgia Dow, who is the senior editor at iMore.com. And we try to talk about video games at least 75% of the show when we're not, you know, making fun of each other or talking about pandas or hand turkeys or breaking furniture or any, whatever the running gag of the week is this week. But we have a lot of fun, and, you know, it's one of those things that it's just a blast to do every week. And the my co-hosts are three of the smartest women you'll ever find. And I'm really lucky to be able to just hang out and talk about video games with them for like an hour and a half every week. So it's a lot of fun.
It's always fun when you get into a podcast where the people who are doing it are having a lot of fun. And sometimes it can be a little, the first episode, you're like, what is going on? And that's true for any podcast where the people who are recording it are having a lot of fun, because they have references and stuff like that. But I always encourage people, no, just like listen to a few episodes, and pretty quickly you understand, oh, they're actually just referring to some of the same things repeatedly, and you understand it doesn't really matter why pandas are a theme of the show. It's just the running joke.
I mean, and pandas went back all the way to that first episode. Yeah. I mean, we had talked like on the phone for like half an hour before that first episode, and then we just kind of fell into this panda gag, and then we just kind of ran with it, and it's been a blast ever since.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Steve, for coming on the show. Thanks everybody for listening. We always want to know what you think, so if you have any thoughts, you can send us an email. If any particular topic suggestions or people you'd like to have us interview, then just let us know. You can send an email, hello@upup.fm, or you can tweet us at @upupshow on Twitter, and see you next week. So what are you, I guess this is probably covered on the Isometric Trick episode that I have not heard yet, but what are you playing, Steve? Other than Rock Band as research
other,
for
other
Up,
than,
Down, Down.
Yeah, other than Rock Band. I've actually been kind of trying a whole bunch of different things, but the game, I'll probably end up talking about this on Isometric too, but I picked up this game called Zeo Drifter on the 3DS. And it's kind of it's like a Metroid, it's like a really retro Metroid Vania type game, where there's like this craft that crashes and it loses its warp drive, and then it kind of ends up in the solar system. You keep bouncing around between these different planets, and you know, you keep fighting this one monster at the end who's the boss every single time, but he just kind of gets more attacks every time that you face him, and then you have to use the different abilities that you that you've collected every time you beat him to beat him a different way. And it, so you start out by being able to turn into a submarine, and then you can kind of, it's got this interesting mechanic where you can phase between the background and the foreground. So they use the 3D a lot. I couldn't do it because I still have an old 3DS, and my eyes hurt too much from doing the 3D. But so you're kind of bouncing back and forth between the background and the foreground of the levels. And it's short. I finished it, which I don't finish a lot of games lately. But it was, so maybe like 3 hours. But I was like addicted to it hardcore, and I just kind of, I beat it over the course of like a day, which I can't remember the last time I did that with any sort of a game. So
it was, time.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I mean, it was on sale for like $5 in the eShop. I definitely got more than $5 worth out of it. So
You mentioned the new 3D. Have either of you seen or gotten much chance to play the new 3DS? Because I've heard from multiple people who weren't really sold on the 3D on the last iteration that it's actually like quite good.
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, I interrogated Brianna about it on our last episode that came out last week because she got it, I think, right after PAX or at PAX, and she's in love with it. I mean, she's usually she's been pretty vocal about how bad Nintendo's hardware is, and she was actually really impressed with it. So, I mean, what I asked her, because there's this, I don't know if you've played Luigi's Mansion.
No.
So
I played it a little bit.
Yeah, so that when you get pretty far into Luigi's Mansion, there's this scene where you're kind of walking on a tightrope, and it uses the motion controls to keep you on a tightrope, which, for a game that relies on 3D as much as it does, is nearly impossible. And she said that she hasn't tried it, but there's no reason to think that wouldn't actually work in 3D on the new 3DS, which is amazing. So,
yeah, and that was always my problem with the 3D. Like, it's amazing that it works as well as it does. And like maybe for a kid with a smaller head, it would be fine. But I found that there was like, you know, there was a space of about 2 inches where I could make the effect work. And so just even like shifting it a little bit by pressing the buttons was enough to break the 3D for me. So what 3DS gaming I've done, which is not a huge amount. I don't actually have a 3DS myself, but I've played a couple of the, you know, a couple of the 3DS games I was really interested on my kids' 3DSs. And yeah, I just have to turn the 3D off. Like, I can't do it. It's too distracting to pop in and out of the 3D and have it like flip on you from moving the thing what seems like a negligible amount.
I mean, a lot of the games now don't bother with the 3D anymore anyway. I mean, it's, you know, they'll put it in. I mean, I'm sure Majora's Mask probably uses it a lot, but a lot of the games that have come out, like the new Pokemon games, like they have a little bit of 3D, but they don't even really bother. And you could see the frame rate drop like dramatically as soon as you flip the Switch on. So, you know, I've never really bothered with it either. And I don't really, it's not really a draw for me. I figure that once my 3DS dies, I'll consider it. But, you know, I've got one, my two kids who care about them have them. So I've got enough Nintendo hardware in the house right now. I don't need to buy another one until I have a reason to, probably when, you know, one of the Circle Pads dies or the battery just, you know, decides to stop pulling a charge or whatever.
I feel like the current surge of 3D in the game industry has been going on for long enough. I'm starting to now feel like it's a pretty long time for a fad, right? That's not to say that it's not, or it is, or is it? It isn't. But like often when there has been like fads and stuff like that, they tend to sort of burn brightly and then fade, whereas it feels like 3D is like just kind of like slowly gaining steam and finding its legs, and maybe there will be a peak and a crash, but I don't know. I've been having a hard time making some sort of statement. Like, we had John Walker on a few episodes ago, and he's like, 3D is a fad, it will fail. And it's like, wow, I wish I was as sure as you were about a position on it.
You know, I feel like it's I mean, I remember Rad Racer, even when you press select and it, you know, went into the red blue mode, but I feel like it's kind of gone away in favor of VR now, like, because Sony was really pushing it hard in the PS3 era towards the end. Like, they even came out with like that monitor that was 3D capable just to get people to please try games in 3D, and nobody bought it. And I haven't really seen that a lot, you know, with the PS4 or the Xbox One or even the Wii U. I mean, none of them are really trying to do that. And I wonder if it's just, this is a stopgap anyway until we get to VR, and that's really where we're going to see a lot of the innovation. And it feels like 3D is almost like a stepping stone that we almost don't need to go to, and that it's just, we'll just go straight to VR, and then we'll figure all that stuff out there.
I mean, currently, like, for console 3D, it's so dependent on having TVs with 3D, which have not particularly taken off. So it's not something that, like, Sony or Microsoft can push on their own. Like, selling a bit of add-on VR hardware, like, yeah, there's, you know, it's going to have all the problems that add-on hardware usually does of having, you know, be a hard sell to get people to pay for it. But it's way worse with TVs, where it's like, well, people have already got their TVs that they paid like $1,000 for. They're not going to pay like $1,000 for another TV to get 3D. Whereas, you know, maybe if you can sell a VR headset for like $400 or something like that, you know, you'll get some people that will be willing to pay that much for an add-on, and as the price comes down, it'll get to be an easier and easier sell. Whereas TVs would need to come down a lot more in price, and people have to replace a piece of hardware that they've already got, and maybe like for other reasons, the particular black level or the size of the TV or how many HDMI inputs it's got. All kinds of stuff. Like it's going to be a much harder sell to get people. I think that's just kind of the reality, is people were sort of hoping like, hey, the TV industry is really pushing 3D TVs. Like if that becomes a thing, then the game consoles can kind of ride those coattails a little bit and get people excited about 3D in games, and 3D TVs just never became a thing.
I don't even know if you can buy one anymore, to be honest with you. I think it's all smart TVs now.
You can definitely buy them, and I think actually a lot of TVs just come with 3D as a matter of course, and then you can add, because all 3D is really just 120 hertz refresh rate, instead of 60, and then you buy the expensive glasses. And like, if you want to, and if you're willing to buy the expensive glasses, they'll sell them to you. But like building it into the TV actually doesn't increase the cost of the TV very much, is part of why they were so excited to offer it. Because it's like, hey, sweet, we can give this upgrade and then sell a bunch of add-on hardware. Has Oculus said anything about pricing? I know that Valve recently, they announced that they're working with HTC on a VR headset that's coming out pretty soon. And Valve has warned that it's going to be on the expensive side, but I don't know what it will be on the side of. Like, I think they're saying it's going to be more expensive than Oculus, but I don't even know how much the Oculus consumer kits are supposed to be.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't heard anything either, though. I imagine that the cost of the Steam VR is not only going to be the headset, but also the gaming rig that you're going to need to run the thing. I mean, if you're running two 1920p displays at a high enough a resolution that things actually look realistic, that's going to be a pretty expensive gaming rig, I would imagine. So on top of whatever the headset's going to cost. So that's going to be, it's going to take a little while for that to come down for, normal humans to be able to afford that.
Yeah, the Oculus development kit too was $350, and that was sort of, there was an implication that was like, it's going to be cheaper when the final thing comes out. I don't know how much people.
Well, I mean, I'd say that's probably a pretty good baseline, because there's probably pressures pushing it in both directions, right? Like the dev kits, they want to sell as close to cost as they can afford to do because they want to get people interested in them. So if you were, if you're selling hardware that you could sell to devs for $350 to get them interested in your technology, like probably you'd want another 10 or 20% markup selling it to consumers to actually make some money off of it. But there's also just the usual economy of scale things, right? That once they're actually manufacturing them, millions at a time, hopefully it'll be a lot cheaper than manufacturing few hundred or few thousand at a time, like they've got to be doing now. So
the hilarious thing about the DK2 is apparently if you disassemble it, the display actually says like Samsung Galaxy S3 or whatever on it.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, right? Isn't the actual, I follow this stuff enough for isometric, but I don't get super wrapped up in it, because I figure that it's always going to be 2 years away. And it's like, once there's something that is out there that I can buy, and then there's actually software for it, is when I'm actually going to start getting interested in it personally, as opposed to just, to have conversations about it on the show. But aren't the dev kits kind of all self-contained, and then the Gear VR that the piece that they said was going to be the commercial version, isn't that going to run off of a smartphone or something like that?
Well, they have two things. So there's the actual serious John Carmack is impressed with this level hardware that they're going to sell, which is the $300-$400 headset, which is the Oculus Rift, and then there's the Gear VR, which is a thing that you can put your phone into, and so those, I think those are two separate things that Oculus is working on. And it's interesting, I was seeing some talk or comment from John Carmack, who like has been really obsessed with like, how can we get this fully immersive, and he tried out he was working on the Gear VR stuff, and he's like, yeah, you can put your smartphone in and like, it's pretty good, I guess. But I mean, it's only 60 hertz or whatever. And then like, he was talking about it a year later, and he's like, yeah, people seem to kind of like it. And he's like almost sort of confused at how much people enjoy it.
Well, sure, because they haven't seen what he's seen either. I mean, if that's all you've seen, then it's probably going to be mind blowing if you haven't seen, what the quote unquote real experience is. I mean, I talk about this stuff every week, and I still have never put my eyes on an Oculus. Like, I've tried to a couple times.
Yeah, Alan and I have talked about that a little bit and figured that if we're ever going to do a VR show, we're going to have to just order an Oculus dev kit and like just to try it out, just to see. Because otherwise it'll be like the two of us and like someone who's actually used one of these things talking about it. Like.
I've used one. I actually, it was Curtis Lassom who's been on the show who has a DK2 and he's... he gave me some demos and stuff like that. But what I haven't done is played a game with it. And that's so much like my understanding is that a lot of what's available for it, or at least what was a year or two ago when the DK2 came out, is demos. It's like, because, you know, it's so intensive on whatever machine you may have to even just show stuff in the low resolution that it is. The demo that I enjoyed the most was I'm sitting in a chair and I'm looking around and like objects are appearing and disappearing behind you. And so like the scene changes dramatically and it's cool effect, but like there's no game to it. It's just like, oh, hey, looks cool. And I think a lot of the motion sickness that people complain about is when you have games where your character starts moving and of course your inner ear says you're not moving. And that's when things start to go sideways. And so I'm not sure what the latest and greatest is on that. I'm sure that there are games you can get in like early access and stuff, but just straight porting like a first-person shooter to it just does not help at all. Like it's not a pleasant experience.
Yeah, there was Dying Light or Evil Within. I forget one of those. They all start to sound alike after a while.
Yeah.
But one of them, and they were talking about how once you know, you're fine when you're standing around and looking around, but once you start to sidestep is really when you start lurching and it's not really going to be, you know, just slapping Rift support onto these games. It's going to be games that are created from the ground up for that, but that's going to be even further away because you need to have a full install base before people can really justify putting the kinds of effort in. And it's probably going to be more effort than, I mean, we have this whole thing about The Order being a 5-hour game, and I would imagine that even a 5-hour game in VR is going to be like an order of magnitude more difficult to build just because of all the extra environments you have to build that you would never even have to show to a player in a standard game. And at that, you know, at a resolution where it's going to be, you know, where it's going to be keep you in the experience and not break the suspension disbelief on top of that.
There are some genres that I think will slot in nicely. I know Alan and I have talked about it offline before. I can't remember if we've talked about it on the podcast before, but like racing games, flight sims, like there's certainly a few genres that it will just kind of be like flip a switch and it's in 3D and it's a pretty good experience. Like you don't need to solve any really hard problems, I feel like, to make like a racing game or a flight sim or, you know, mech combat game or something like that work with one of these rigs. It's it'll be like, how do we get the other genres that people like in a way that doesn't nauseate them?
Yeah, maybe we'll finally get the Steel Battalion that they've been trying to make for like the last 15 years.
If I had a chance to like pin Gabe Newell in a bar and like have whiskey with him and get him on his truthy side, I would be like, well, after figuring out what's going on with Half-Life 3, I would be like, okay, what is the deal with Valve as a company that makes exclusively first-person shooters being so invested in VR, which does not work for first-person shooters? What's the deal with that, Gabe? And I'm sure he would have some thoughtful, you know, like, oh, well, no, this is the future, so we need to adapt. Or it might be like, no, we have this crazy thing we're going to do. But it's a mystery to me. Maybe just Dota in 3D.
Well, there you go. That'll be lots of fun. They had some sort of like a Civ type game where you were kind of like looking down on the board from above. And
well, Nigel was talking about this demos. Like there's a problem with the field of view distance if the objects are small that you're, or if you're looking down on a board of a Civ type game and it's supposed to represent the world, but it is a certain distance from you, and basically it effectively, because of the interocular distance in between your eyes that has to make the 3D effect, instead it just looks like miniatures as opposed to looking like the world. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, you always have to kind of pick in 3D between making something look like it's a miniature or making it look like not 3D at all. Because if you're actually hovering like, you know, 200 meters over top of some field of battle, like you don't really get a very strong 3D effect on guys running around on that field, right? So what you always end up doing is cranking up the interocular and then it looks like models.
Yeah, but for a turn-based strategy game, that could kind of work, like that kind of, like almost like a tilt-shift effect type of thing where, you know, maybe it's okay for them to look like miniatures because, you know, you're moving pieces around on a board rather than,
yeah,
like commanding armies. And
if it's stylized, as long as it's, yeah, not trying to be like some serious World War II game and there's like these tanks, except that they look like tiny dinky tanks. And that's just not as impressive.